You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, making new friends can be really hard, especially as a grown-up. And keeping up those existing friendships as life changes can be a big challenge, too. Our next guest says the science of attachment can teach us a lot about our own strengths and weaknesses as friends and what we look for in friendships. And she's got advice to make it easier to find new friends and to be a good friend to the ones you've got. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a friendship in your life that's really been important to you? What works for maintaining close friendships in your own life? Have you found ways to make new friends, or is it a challenge for you like it is for a lot of people? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Marissa G. Franco is an assistant clinical professor of university honors at the University of Maryland. She's the author of the new book, Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. Marissa, thanks a lot for joining us.
Me.
Now, you opened the book with a personal moment for you. A romantic relationship ended. And tell us how important your friends were in rising up from that moment.
Yeah, so to heal from that at the time, I decided to start this wellness group with my friends where we would meditate, cook, do yoga together, and I just really felt the love from all of them, and it led me to question some ideas that I had about love, that romantic love was the only love that counted, the only love that made me worthy, that, you know, proved my value. And so I started to wonder, why doesn't platonic love matter? Like, why hasn't it mattered to me that I'm loved by all of these people? Why have I treated it like this is secondary and illegitimate and romantic love is the only legitimate form of connection? So I sort of went on a quest to level this hierarchy of love that I think hurts people who are within and outside of romantic relationships because it makes us really devalue friendship. And so that's part of the reason that I decided to write Platonic.
I think we all might know, yeah, having friends, that's a good thing. Nothing wrong with that. You really lay out how important friends can be in having those connections. What are some of the benefits of having good friendships?
Yeah. So loneliness is as toxic for our bodies as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And you might think, okay, but I can cure my loneliness through my spouse or my family, right? But there's actually three types of loneliness, only one in which can be met through a spouse, which is intimate loneliness, the desire for someone to have a very close connection with, like you have with a spouse or a best friend. But there's also relational loneliness. We have a desire for people that are about as close to us as a friend. And then collective loneliness, which is the desire for being part of a group that's working towards a common goal. And any of these forms of loneliness can be at play, such that even if we're very happy with our spouse, we can still end up feeling lonely because basically this suggests that we've always needed an entire community to feel truly whole.
And you share some of the numbers there. We Americans are kind of bad at this. Our numbers of friends, our friend networks are going down from year to year. What do you think is driving that?
Oh, man, so many different factors. You know, it really started with the creation of the television in the 1950s. And before then, leisure was a public affair that people did with their friends when they had free time. They just spent it with other people. But then people just started to spend their free time in front of the television. And in 2012, we also see spikes in loneliness. And that's around the time when the smartphone really became popular. And of course, there's ways to use technology to foster connection. But what it does is it has opportunity costs, right? That if we're using this technology every day for entertainment, to pass the time, we're not hanging out, which is what we would do if we were maybe more bored and didn't have this low-hanging fruit that gives us almost a snack of connection, parasocial connections. We feel connected to people we don't even know. And the snack makes us not realize just how hungry we are for the full meal of connection, the in-person interaction.
We're talking to Marissa G. Franco about her new book. It's called Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has friendship been an important thing in your life? Do you have a friend you want to talk about with us? Or has it been a challenge for you, maybe as you age? Spend more time with your family. Is it harder to make and keep friendships? Or have you moved someplace new? What worked? What didn't work with making new friends? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Marissa, let's get to work. In that situation, somebody's thinking, yeah, gosh, I want more friends, but you don't want to just walk up to another grown-up and say, will you be my friend? How do we get started?
Yeah, the first thing is we have to let go of the idea that friendship happens organically. Mm-hmm. As adults, it does not. As kids, we have these ingredients, continuous unplanned interaction and shared vulnerability. We see people every day. We let our guard down through gym, recess, right? And that's what fosters organic connection. As adults, we no longer are inhabiting settings like that, right? At work, we see people every day, but we usually are not particularly vulnerable with our colleagues. So that means that you can't rely on friendship happening organically. In fact, doing so is related to being more lonely over time. And you're going to have to initiate. Now, people are very afraid of initiating, but I like to share with people, the research actually finds people are less likely to reject you than you think. There's research on a phenomenon called the liking gap, wherein when strangers interact and are asked to predict, how much do you think the other person likes you? We tend to underestimate just how liked we are. The more self-critical we are, the more pronounced this underestimation. So I suggest assume people like you. Because according to other research on something called the acceptance prophecy, when people are told that they'll go into a group and be liked based on their personality profile, and that even if this is a lie, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because it makes people warmer, friendlier, more engaged.
On a practical level, so we know somebody at work or a friend of a friend or whatever, what are some ways to build that relationship in a friendshiply direction?
Yeah. So, right, I talked about the problem at work being that we only show one dimension of us. A great way to bring out multiple dimensions of us is something called repotting, which was created by Ryan Hubbard at the Kite String Project. And that's the idea of varying the settings in which we interact, right? So stop interacting at work, stop talking about work, like share who you are as a real person, say to them like, oh, it's been so nice to like get to know you at work. Like, would you want to go for a walk after work? Or, you know, I was going to go to the museum this weekend. Would you be up for that? Right. And that also makes the friendship more sustainable. People complain, well, when the work is over, we no longer see each other. But once you have precedent for seeing each other, even when you're not in the working hours, it's going to be easier to maintain it if there's transitions as well.
Now, you write about the psychology of our attachment styles. What is an attachment style and how does it affect our friendship journeys?
Yeah, great question. So attachment style is basically a template we have for how people will treat us that we create in childhood and update throughout life. And this template we have, this expectation for how other people will treat us, is ridden with confirmation bias, such that we see in the world things that match our expectation and discount experiences that don't match it. So there's three major attachment styles. Secure people. Their template is people are trustworthy. They'll love me. They'll accept me. And that means they behave in ways that reflect this template. They are open, vulnerable, better at initiating friendships, less likely to end friendships, according to the research. They move away from people that aren't nice and aren't friendly. They're just very comfortable with themselves. They assume people like them, right? Versus anxiously attached people whose template is people are going to abandon you. So how do they navigate friendships because of that? They move very quickly, are sort of like overshare from the beginning, tend to have these very fragile friendships. They assume they're being rejected even when they're not. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because then they try to reject because they think they're rejected. And they sort of manifest their greatest fears because of that. And then you have avoidantly attached people who are also afraid of abandonment and fundamentally think others are untrustworthy. So how do they handle these fears? The avoidantly attached people, they keep to themselves. They're the lone wolves. They're never vulnerable. They're not really trying in their friendships. They end up ghosting more than other attachment styles. People feel like I'm around him, but I don't actually know him because he never actually shares anything about himself. They suppress their emotions. They're very uncomfortable with anyone else's emotions. So conflict is a big fear of them. They can be sort of people pleasing, so they don't have to face some emotions in others.
We're talking to psychologist Marissa G. Franco about her new book, Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Kind of surprised. I guess we don't have friends in Wisconsin. Do you have a story of friendship you want to share with us? Do you need some advice from our guest on maybe making a friendship or maintaining past friendships? Love to hear from you. If you have a question, a thought, an experience you would like to share about making or maybe losing friends along the way, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Marissa G. Franco about her new book. It's called Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. You can join in with your story of friendship, maybe a tough time in your life where you've had trouble making friends, maybe after moving or moving to a new job, say. What's worked for you? What doesn't? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Elizabeth is with us in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm known for keeping in touch with my friends. They always talk about how great I am about doing that. I have friends from 30, 40, 45 years back that I've kept in touch with. And I think that friendship, it does take work or effort to be able to keep in touch with people and, you know, keep up with their addresses or emails or new phone numbers. But it's really worth it, and I just think that was the important point I wanted to make.
I love it, Elizabeth. I'll tell you, you're a better friend than I am, and probably a better person, too. Marissa, I'm the opposite of Elizabeth. I'm famously abysmal at keeping in touch with people, and I'm one of those people who gets, you know, I feel guilty, and I'm like, oh, it's too late. I can't, you know, I feel like an idiot if I reach out. How do we be more like Elizabeth than like me?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's lovely that you have positive intent. And Elizabeth, I'm glad that you are able to do all of those things, because I'm sure you're making other people feel so, so loved. I think part of the ways we get better at it is we change our framework for friendship. I think a lot of us have this frame of friends. It's good vibes only. It's easy. It's not that. And so it's not on our list of priorities, right? Because of how we've just been socialized and conditioned to see it. But in fact, I think I argue that there's a difference between good company and a good friend. That good company is someone whose time you enjoy. They put you in a good mood, right? You like them as a person, but that is not a good friend. To be a good friend, it's a responsibility, an investment, a commitment in another person, right? It's, I'm going to be there to support you in your times of need. I'm going to try to make you feel safe when you're vulnerable. When you succeed, I'm going to celebrate you, right? I think our framework for friends needs to be more similar to our framework for romance, which is I need to put in time and effort. And there's times where this is going to be hard, but I also know that it's really worth it. And so it's really making friendship a priority amidst all of our other priorities.
Thanks again for that call, Elizabeth, at 800-642-1234. Paul joins us next in Northern Illinois. Paul, hi.
Hey, how's it going, Rob? I love your show. You know it.
Thanks.
I wanted to, I had to laugh when I was listening. I heard this, hi, my name's Paul. Will you be my friend? And actually, that's how my wife describes me. And I guess I'm trying to understand, is there a potential to have a combination of these friendships? In other words, I have friends that I consistently meet up with, and we go through the deeper deeps. And then I have wonderful companions, like a girl that I met in an airplane that took me all around, you know, a Caribbean island because we just happened to talk on the plane together with my wife. I'm just curious, like, are there gray lines? You know,
Paul, I think I gotcha. We can have a variety of friends, maybe Marissa, with a variety of roles in our lives.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a great question. And, you know, I think that's the beauty of friendship, that it can occur on such a spectrum, right? Like Now some people are even choosing friends for their life partners, but we also have these sort of friendly acquaintances. I also talk about in the book this idea of low-dose friends, right? There's some people that we like some parts of them, we don't like others, and you might think, oh, this person can't be my friend, but in fact, you could really enjoy their company at low doses. If you see them once a month, you're like, oh, I'm happy, that was nice. But if you see them more frequently, it's like, oh, no. And so that's the beauty of friendship. We can sort of turn the dial down or turn the dial up based off of the connection we have, the degree of compatibility that we feel. And so it can just give us so much versatility.
Paul, thanks a lot for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Talking to Marissa G. Franco. Her new book is called Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Matt is with us in Wonder Lake, Illinois. Matt, hi.
Hi, love WPR, love the Ideas Network. I just wanted to comment really quick. You know, I was a millennial in Chicago, went to art school, had a number of bands, a couple of my bands toured the world, and we had incredible experiences together. However, like after the pandemic, we all seemed to go our separate ways, and it's been really, really tough reestablishing some sort of connection with my former bandmates and the people that I was so close to making art with. And I just wanted to speak on that. And, you know, I really try to make an effort, and you know, when those efforts aren't reciprocated, it can be kind of hurtful. So I just wanted to speak on that and just say, you know, continue to reach out to your good friends, and hopefully one day you'll be able to hang out with them in the same capacity again. So thank you.
Matt, thanks a lot for that call. Marissa, I'm guessing Matt is very much not alone in that, you know, pandemic disruption of the life with friends. Do you have some advice for him and other people in that situation trying to rebuild?
Yeah, well, Matt, I really love your investment in your previous friendships. I think more generally, we saw in the pandemic a sort of split in how friendship was affected, right? For those people that your friendship is a companionate friendship, it's contingent on you doing activities together, it was a real blow. We couldn't do activities together. But for those people whose friendship was founded on sharing the deep, vulnerable, profound stuff, right? Reaching out when we're struggling and getting support, those friendships were a little bit more durable because we all needed support. So, hey, we were able to access them. It looks like this caller is sort of struggling because he's still invested in these friendships and his friends aren't. I think just some follow-up questions I have to ask is that, you know, we tend to devalue our friendships more if we don't see them in person. So have you tried to see these friends in person so they can sort of recognize your chemistry and your dynamic and how much they value you, right? That when we're apart from people, it's hard for us to viscerally feel that connection in the same way than when we're in person. I think it's also helpful to think about friendship as flexible, not fragile. What I mean by that is friendships ebb and flow, right? And if you're in an ebb and you assume it's fragile, then you're going to assume it's over and you're not going to reach out anymore. But it might be that this is going to flow again at another time when, you know, your friends are in a good place. So you can sort of treat it that way. That being said, I hear that it hurts when the relationships don't feel so reciprocal and you're the only one reaching out. And I also wanted to say, it'll be important to find relationships that are reciprocal, right? To find those people that are ready and available. And we tend to find those in transitioners. That's people who just moved to a city, who are going through a divorce or breakup, who just retired. They tend to be particularly open to friendship. So I think that's a good place to start.
Thanks for that call. Good luck. Hope that helps. Time for one more caller. Kimberly is with us in Arena. Kimberly, hi.
Hi. So I tend to be the extroverted friend. I'm the one that's always taking my crew of introverted friends along with me because I'm making all of the decisions or, hey, let's all go out here at night. And I've just been kind of experiencing a lot of decision fatigue from that lately, and so then I end up staying home because I don't want to go out and make decisions or make everybody go someplace, so then everybody else ends up staying home.
And
I just keep going through the same cycles because then I'll be tired, we won't do anything, and then go right back to it, and we just can't seem to find a balance. I don't know.
Interesting. Kimberly, thanks for the call. Marissa, briefly, do you have advice for Kimberly to have some of those introverts get on board and organize it and make some of the decisions?
Yeah, Kimberly, I think maybe trying to automate your hangouts, like every other Wednesday we're going to go to this restaurant or every other Wednesday we're going to choose to go to someone's house can be a really great way to do it. The other thing I wonder is if you've made your expectations, if you have sort of them in an upfront way, right? Or if you're just sort of upset about this and hoping someone will kind of get the hint. And I think just saying something as simple as like, hey, y'all, really want to see y'all. Coordinating, being the coordinator can sometimes be hard on me. Would we be open to sort of rotating who sets up our plans and see what they say?
Good luck, Kimberly. In just our last minute or so, Marissa, rescuing the word love. I think we just think of romantic love in our society now. Make the case for thinking of love as something we have for our friends.
So there's this Italian philosopher who says platonic love is a love so beautiful that it transcends the physical. And so I think we can see that each love is beautiful. Romantic love is beautiful, but platonic love is beautiful too. And it, in its non-sexual nature, right, it provides us with its own offerings in its fluidity. It provides us with its own offerings and its versatility, right? In the fact that our friends can be an entire community, whereas for most of us, our spouse is limited to one person. It provides us with unique offerings, which make it so that friendships cannot be replaced by any other type of relationship.
Marissa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Marissa G. Franco, psychologist with the University of Maryland. She's with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Platonic, How the Science of Attachment Can Help You Make and Keep Friends. Hey, if you want to shout out one of your friends, we would love to hear from you. You can email ideas@WPR.org or head over and post on the Ideas Network Facebook page with a story of a friendship that's been important in your own life. At the end of every week here on Central Time, it's Food Friday. We'll get recipes, advice, and inspiration for baking and cooking with all kinds of ingredients. That's on the air each Friday, or you can check out our archives anytime at WPR.org/Food Friday. Try out a recipe there and let us know how it goes. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Language can be used to connect people, but sometimes language rules can cause confusion and arguments, even among friends, family, and spouses. But help is on the way. Our next guest hit the road and traveled around the country, including here to Wisconsin, to set up a grammar table and answer questions from passerbys, or I guess passersby. She joins us now to share that experience and to tackle some of the funky twists and turns of spelling, punctuation, grammar, and more. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a nagging grammar question? Maybe a dispute you have with a friend or loved one? Is there something that you always stumble over when it comes to spelling something or how to write something or how to punctuate it? You name it. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ellen Jovan is the co-founder of a communication skills training consultancy called Syntaxis. She's the author of the new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. Ellen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob, for letting me take my grammar party inside on this hot day. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. How did you get started as a roving grammarian setting up your grammar advice table?
I wasn't that roving at first. At first, I like grammar, in case that isn't clear yet. And one day I said, hey, I need a grammar table. So I ordered a table, made a sign, and I walked outside my building. There's a little park right there. So I didn't even have to go a full block. And I put it down and I started answering questions. So I roved one block initially, but then I started moving further around the city and eventually around the country.
And people, you set up shop here with your table, and people, it seems like, were really interested. They came up and had conversations and questions and arguments they had on hand. People love to talk about this with you.
They really do. To me, it's not surprising at all. Sometimes people say, who cares about grammar? No one cares about grammar anymore. And I'm thinking, you need to sit at the table with me for an hour, because people definitely care about it. They love talking about it. They love fake fighting about it. It can be really hilarious. It's this wonderful bonding instrument for conversation.
Let's get a taste of it. You shared an example with us from a grammar table interaction, this one in Milwaukee. So we can get a flavor of what's going on here. Here's a listen.
It's the grammar table. Do you have any grammar questions?
Yes. The use of commas. Both.
Commas
It's like to describe stuff, like more than one thing. Like
if you have a list.
Dark brown hair, blue eyes, red lips, stuff like that.
That was very visually, I can't think of a word right now. You've left the grammar table speechless. So are you asking about the comma before the and, if it's a list of things?
No, how do we use more commas? We choose not to use commas at all, just a stream of consciousness.
Is this the collective familial we, or does we mean your kids?
My kids.
Sounds like this was a lot of fun. And I think a key, Ellen, is that you're not judgy about this at all, as far as I can tell. You wouldn't correct me and say, don't you mean judgmental, Rob?
I definitely wouldn't. I don't feel judgmental at all. I just think to me, this is really fun, and I'll just answer whatever question people have. I don't tackle them when they walk by. If I hear them use the wrong past participle, that's not how this works.
We're talking to Ellen Jovan, author of the new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. She brought her grammar table to almost every state in the country, including Wisconsin, to answer questions for people. And you can join in with your questions, your grammatical conflicts and confusions. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go to your calls now. Al is with us in Green Bay. Al, hello.
Thanks for taking my call. So my question involves the word unique. I was brought up to believe that unique means one of a kind. Therefore, you would never put a modifier with it. You wouldn't say somewhat unique or kind of unique, because unique means one of a kind. It doesn't mean kind of one of a kind. But in later years, I've had other people try to tell me that unique simply means unusual. What's the ruling?
Al, thanks for the call. Ellen, how unique does something have to be before we can call it unique?
There's so many things that I could say about this, Al. I personally do not modify my unique. I use it as an absolute. So something is unique or not. I think the word is kind of spoiled because, you know, people who promote things like to make things very unique, extremely unique. And after a while, it just stops having the zing that it, you know, for me, it doesn't have much zing anymore. But It is used also by people to mean unusual, and it definitely takes on that meaning for me when they put an adverb in front of it. I just don't happen to do it myself. So, Al, I have your back. I follow your ways, and, you know, the world changes around us, right?
Thanks for that call. And, you know, I always think of the United States Constitution. What are we going to create? A more perfect union, right? And some people, I think, to this day say, well, perfect, you're either perfect or you're not. And how do you get more perfect? But so this kind of question has been around a long time.
I mean, I think I kind of sympathize with the there can be a more perfect or more unique thing. Yeah, because if you have a tiny blue marble and then you have a somewhat like a twice as big blue marble next to it, you can say that, okay, in the collection of small marbles, that bigger blue one is unique. But what if you then have a green one that's 100 times as big? The gap between them is bigger. And I think that is captured by the language, even though people don't like it.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Lexi is with us in Elkhorn. Lexi, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the show. And I really love the title of the guest book. I just want to say that first. That's great. My question is about pleaded versus pled. Like, why do I hear on the radio, he pleaded guilty? I think that's what I hear. And I want, like, my ear wants me to hear pled, like he pled guilty, but I don't hear people say that anymore. So I'm wondering what the difference is. And my ear just wants to hear that. It's a weird thing. Like, it hurts my ears when I hear pleaded guilty. And I also wanted to know how the guest became a grammar expert. That would be really interesting to me. And thank you.
Lexi, thanks for the call. Yeah, I think pled is right, but it's a really weird sound word, like pled. I don't know. Question, Ellen.
Yeah, so this is an example of the kind of thing that I bring out usage books for. You know, so when I set up the table, I always have this big pile of books, and I rely on Brian Garner's book, Garner's Modern English Usage for Things Like This, because he's a legal lexicographer. So may I just quote him briefly here for Lexi? Pleaded has always been the predominant past tense and past participial form. From the early 1600s, pleaded has appeared much more frequently in print sources than its rivals. Commentators on usage have long preferred it, pouring drops of vitriol onto has pled and has, oh, pled spelled E-A-D in that case. So my ear is used to pled, but you know, this is one of the words actually that I have a little bit of an experiential gap between me and the usage experts on. And there's a whole bunch more on that I won't read to you, but it's more complicated often than people
Interesting.
Think.
Interesting.
And then there was the second part. Oh, how
did you become
time?
A grammar expert? Yeah, okay. Just give a quick origin story, maybe.
Okay. Yeah. I have taught writing and grammar my entire life. I majored in language and literature types of things. I have a degree in German and an MA in comparative literature. I have studied 25 languages, well, more than that on my own. And I'm sitting in front of a giant library of grammar books right now. So it's a lifelong obsession.
All right. Let's go back to our callers now. Thanks for that. Becky is with us in Rio. Becky, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the program. It's really interesting. So the word that hurts my ears is the plural of attorney general. I think it used to be attorney generals. Now I always hear attorneys general, and that just sounds awkward to me. Is that correct, or why has it changed?
Ooh, is it correct, and has it changed, Ellen?
I'm not aware of that having changed. I think I can't say for sure what the frequency is of the plural formations unless I go check a database for you. But I've always, my whole life, which has been a little bit, you know, it's longer than average for the planet now. I've always done attorneys general, and I suspect that you just hear both because people are doing both. That's how it often is with language, but I would do attorneys general.
Yeah, because in this case, you think general, oh, that's like a military rank, so you're like the attorney general. But actually, it's a general is a modifier of attorney. Like, you do lots of different stuff. So it's attorneys
exactly.
general. Did I
exactly.
get that right? Excellent.
Yeah, and you say, and I also say mothers-in-law.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I would too, for sure. Thanks. That's a great question at 800-642-1234. Let's go down to Bill in Milwaukee. Bill, hello.
Hello. I have a sentence for you. The Austrian crystal chandelier crashed to the floor below. Now, I was told that the names of countries are always adjectives, but in this one, it's an adverb. I've gotten in fights about this. What do you think?
Fights? Okay. Okay. Oh, I get it. The distinction here is the chandelier Austrian, yeah, or is it a type of crystal called Austrian crystal?
Uh-huh.
Bill, may I ask you, how did this even come up? Do you always parse sentences that you encounter?
I gave this to my students as a question on an exam. It was always fun to debate about it, but a guy in a bar really got mad. He said that the names of countries are always adjectives. I said that this one is describing an adjective, which makes it an adverb.
I don't know.
Austrian. As an adverb.
I gotcha. Bill, I don't know how much time you've spent in Ellen, but we spent all our time getting into fist fights in bars over grammar and language. Basically.
Wow,
do you have a ruling for Bill on this one?
Well, I suspect, you know, it's funny because I grew up with, you know, sort of traditional grammar. I suspect linguists would probably not I would have to check with my linguist friends. I think they would probably not categorize it as adverbial strictly, but I see the point. I'm going to have to think about that.
All right, Bill, thanks a lot. Keep it calm out there, man. We're talking with grammar and language expert Ellen Jovan about her experiences operating a public grammar advice table around the country. She shares the story in her new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something that's always nagged at you about grammar, spelling, punctuation, pronunciation? Do you have a pet peeve or you need something resolved? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Ellen Jovin about her new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. Let's go back to your many calls at 800-642-1234. We just heard about Austrian Crystal. Now we'll go to Crystal Lake, Illinois with Carol. Carol, hi.
Hi, Rob. I can tell Ellen just loves her job just by that laugh. You can just tell. My query is about literally, and my beloved daughter uses it constantly, and I think, what does she mean? And then I'm seeing it written. A lot of people are using that now. What are they talking about?
Literally is literally everywhere, Ellen.
Don't start trouble here. Yeah, I mean, so when people say literally X happened and it didn't actually happen, it's a kind of hyperbolic statement. So I get it. Like I might say, oh my gosh, my head exploded when I heard that. And my head didn't actually explode. So I think that's kind of the idea behind the literally as non-literally supporting. That's that argument. I personally don't do that particular one. I exaggerate in many other ways.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Ellen, it seems like a lot of people have that pet peeve, that one or two or maybe 50 language things that bug them a lot.
It's true. And I actually think it serves various social functions that we probably can't quite grasp when we're busy arguing about them. I mean, so first of all, you often have peevers, like people who have peeves that they want to peeve about. And then you have peevers about peevers, who are the peevers who complain about the peevers. Well, no, they're not peevers. They peeve about the peevers, which is a form of peeving. And it's kind of like this cycle. And it's sort of what I like about it is that even when people get annoyed, it doesn't usually come to fist fights. And I think there's a certain catharsis and a bonding thing in it, as long as it's not too mean. I don't like the mean-spirited peeving. Mm.
And we can say peever and peeving and to peeve. That's
I mean,
all cool.
I made up two words already this afternoon, so
yeah,
I'm
I do it all the time too.
To ask if you want strict rules about that.
Thanks again for the call. Mike is with us next in Eau Claire. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have, I guess, a pet peeve, too, when people say things like between you and I, and I know it should be between you and me. And I actually had a boss at work. I almost got into an argument with her, but I knew better, you know, than to try to argue with my boss about it. But I said between you and me, and, yeah, she corrected me. It's between you and I, Mike.
Uh-oh. So. Right. Mike, thanks a lot for that. It gets tricky, though, Ellen, because depending on where it is in a sense, like you and I are having a conversation, but this land was made for you and me. And then I don't know, it's easy to start second guessing you and
Rob,
me.
That was so beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
May I respond?
Yeah, yeah.
Comment? Do I have time?
Definitely. Oh, we got lots of time.
Okay. So I actually was in an interview. I teach grammar courses to adults. So I was in an interview with a company where I was going to teach grammar courses for their employees. This was almost 20 years ago. And I said, you can feel free to call Brant or me. That's my partner, or me. And then the person interviewing me asked about it because she thought it was wrong. And I explained it. And then I did not get that job. And the point of this is that there is grammar and then there's the politics of grammar.
Oh, well, I hope you got a better job after that with somebody more grammatically understanding. Thanks again for calling Ellen and me. We'll go next to Becky in Whitefish Bay. Becky, hello.
Oh, hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. And I love this program. I love this topic right now. I have taught English language learners for almost 20 years. And the thing that gets to me is when people say conversate instead of converse. I've always thought it was converse, and I think that people say conversate maybe as default because of conversation.
Huh.
But that really irks me.
Becky, thanks. Ellen, I don't think I've encountered conversate all that often. Have you?
Oh, many, many times. It's really common. But you know, I have talked to a lot of people
True.
About these things. Yeah, I, you know, it's, there are often coexisting forms of verbs, and some of them are more common, or of words generally, not just of verbs, and that some are more common in certain dialects than in others. So I hear that among some demographics and less among others. And I, you know, I don't say it, but I've gotten used to it. And I think it's always, when there's a clash in a word that we use a lot or hear a lot, there's always a little clash in our brain as we process it. So I just wish for peace for you.
Becky, thanks a lot for that call. I'm conversating with Ellen Jovin. Her new book is called Rebel with the Claws, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Katie is with us now in Eau Claire. Katie, hello.
Good afternoon. I have a question about the word memoir and when somebody has written a collection of their life stories, is it their memoirs or have they written a memoir?
Oh, they both sound vaguely right to me, Ellen. What's the deal?
You're the first person who's ever asked me about that.
Huh.
I wrote my memoir. I mean, I think my default is singular, but I would actually have to investigate the history of that one to be certain. I try to be very responsible in the information dispensed from the grammar table. So, by the way, Rob, I'm going to also be posting on my Twitter account about the Austrian crystal question, because I think traditional grammarians will say adverb and the not, and linguists will say something else. So I will also bring this one up there because this is fun for my grammar table language polls.
Excellent. All right. I will look for that later. Time for another call or two. Drew is with us in Grafton. Drew, hi. Are you there, Drew? Not hearing Drew. Let's try Victoria in Menominee. Victoria, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Victoria?
My biggest pet peeve is when people say axe instead of ask. I would just like to slap them.
Victoria, thanks for the call. Now, there are a lot of words where kind of, you know, vowel or consonants will flip-flop, like, or you know, nuclear, axe instead of ask. What do you think about that one, Ellen?
Yeah, there's actually a long history for that kind of thing where you see that flipping. That's not an area of expertise for me. That's more a linguist domain. I believe John McWhorter, the linguist, has written about that, but it actually goes back a lot longer than people think, and has affected language in more ways, I suspect, than we realize. It's also part of African American vernacular, so you might hear it more there. So it's also, you know, within certain groups, you hear certain things more than others. I grew up near the Valley in the 80s in Los Angeles. So there are things that I am doing right now that are probably annoying people, and they may write to me about it afterwards.
Thanks for the call, Victoria. Todd is with us now, calling from north of Toma. Todd, hello.
Hi there. I was calling about the terms data and datum. And data to me is a plural term. So the data are compelling, but I hear it actually on NPR a fair amount, where people use data as a singular.
Todd, great question. You cover this in the book, Ellen. I try to write around it, so I never say data is or data are. I just change the damn sentence. What do you think?
I love this topic. I love all the grammar topics that intersect a little bit with mathy kinds of things. I love that extra. Somehow I haven't noticed that catching on as much with some other people, but I love it. Data came into English as a plural and datum came in as the singular, but here's reality for me. I cannot remember ever in my life hearing someone say datum, except maybe in some kind of scientific analysis. Data is used as a plural countable noun, but it is also used as a synonym for information generally. So the further you are away from a quantitative analysis with data points, the more likely you are to hear it as a singular. And I consider both acceptable.
Thanks for everybody's calls. And Ellen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I loved it.
That's Ellen Jovin, author of the new book, Rebel with the Claws, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time.